Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 24. As always, before we get started, I'd like to thank you for your support. It's been 2 years now since I started doing these. I think they've been a big success. More people have signed up on Patreon, but more than that, it's been really fun to interact more with you guys, learn what interests you, and to finally have an outlet to share stuff that I find interesting but doesn't have a place in the regular episodes. These bonus episodes are a lot of work, but I actually look forward to doing them every month. So if you're listening to this, thank you for being a part of the show. I'd also like to thank those of you who submit questions. One of my big worries when I started this was that I wouldn't get any good questions and would have nothing to talk about. But we've actually had the opposite problem. There are too many good questions to get to, and too many that anticipate things I'm already planning to talk about in the main narrative. I often say I couldn't do this without you, and I really do mean that. Thank you for your support. Anyway, on to your questions. First, Marcus Roth asked, what about Luxembourg? Same question as the last dispatch, but for Luxembourg. Well, the first thing to understand before we launch into this question is that Luxembourg is an absolutely massive country compared to Andorra. That might sound silly, given how small Luxembourg looks on a world map, but it's over 5 times larger than Andorra. So that's roughly the same as comparing the US to Afghanistan, or comparing Great Britain to the Bahamas. Andorra is basically just a few valleys in a remote area of the Pyrenees. Luxembourg is big enough to have real geographic diversity. There are forests, mountains, and farmland. The capital city of the same name is a proper urban center, and has been for centuries. Luxembourg is often referred to as a city-state, but it's big enough that there are actually a few towns of significant size outside the capital. Although in the Napoleonic era, these were only rural villages, and Luxembourg City itself was only a large town. Andorra was able to preserve its independence in large part because, no offense to the Andorrans, no one wanted it badly enough to take it over. With France and Spain having roughly equal influence over the little country, neither saw the need to go to the trouble of securing and maintaining control over such a remote area. Luxembourg has remained independent for almost the opposite reason. Historically, this was a very valuable piece of real estate. Everyone wanted Luxembourg. So it was eventually decided it was better for the whole continent if no great power had control over it. We'll get to that in a moment. Luxembourg City is a perfect natural fortification, perched high in rocky mountains, surrounded by cliffs and rugged hills, with not one but 2 rivers running through it. From the heights of Luxembourg City, there is a perfect unobstructed 360-degree view of the entire surrounding area, stretching on for miles. With only minimal preparations, a determined defender could hold this position against much stronger attackers almost indefinitely. It also occupies an important strategic position. As we've discussed, Luxembourg is surrounded by rough country, rocky hills, forests, and mountains. But not far to the north, the terrain changes. The Low Countries are called the Low Countries for a reason. They are mostly flat, perfect ground for rapid movements of marching armies. And before the invention of the steamboat, the ports of the Low Countries were the best place in Europe to launch ships bound for England. Since ancient times, European military leaders have recognized the strategic importance of the Low Countries. I think it's fair to say that coastal plain along the English Channel is one of the most significant strategic locations on the continent. So Luxembourg is a perfect natural fortress just beyond this region, a perfect springboard for anyone hoping to launch an attack through the Low Countries, and a perfect stronghold for anyone hoping to defend themselves from an attack through this region. By the eve of the French Revolution, it also had extensive modern fortifications. In many past episodes, we've discussed Lazare Carnot, the great military theorist turned politician, who served under every revolutionary government, then under Napoleon. He was nicknamed the Organizer of Victory for his work rebuilding and reforming the French army. Carnot was a military engineer by trade, trained to build and evaluate fortifications. He considered Luxembourg the second strongest position in the world, after the British fortress of Gibraltar. Think about how much time we spent talking about the famous Austrian fortress city of Mantua in northern Italy during our episodes on the First Italian Campaign. Well, in Carnot's expert opinion, Mantua was a weaker fortress than Luxembourg. As you may remember, there was a lot of fighting in and around the Low Countries during the War of the First Coalition, especially in the early phases. At the outbreak of the war, Luxembourg was part of the Austrian Netherlands. It had a huge garrison, 15,000 Habsburg troops, nearly the size of an entire army corps, plus almost 1,000 cannon, more than enough to cover every viable approach to the city. French forces arrived outside the fortifications in late November 1794 and placed the city under siege. It was a hard-fought affair. The Republicans had to slowly work their way towards those imposing walls, building their trenches and batteries ever closer in ever smaller concentric rings. The Austrians fought back tenaciously, bombarding the French lines daily and launching sorties when they could. As is often the case in sieges, the attackers suffered badly. It was cold and rainy for much of the siege. Those trenches must have been muddy and miserable. Disease was a problem as well, actually killing the French commander, General Jean-René Moreau. At any given time, much of the besieging force was actually away from the lines, foraging for food. According to one source, the French took so much food from the surrounding countryside during those months that there were famine conditions in the rural areas outside the fortress. Finally, in the early summer of 1795, the French managed to get close enough to the city to set up mortars in an area where they could fire on the fortifications but were not visible to the Austrians. The French could now bombard the garrison at will without any fear of counter-battery fire. The Austrians held on for a few more weeks, trying to launch night attacks on this position, but had no success. Finally, on June 7, 1795, the great fortress surrendered. The garrison had held out for just shy of 200 days, with no help whatsoever from the outside world. But with that mortar battery, there was no hope for any further resistance. Not long after Luxembourg fell to the French, the whole region was annexed into the Republic. It became part of a new department, the Department of Forêt, or literally Forests, named after the surrounding Ardennes Forest. It included most of the modern country of Luxembourg, plus significant slices of modern-day Belgium and Germany. French rule was not popular. We've discussed this in past episodes, and it's the same pattern here. The Republicans brought competent, modern administration, but also profound social and economic disruption, high taxes, and conscription. Just like their neighbors in Belgium, the people of Luxembourg rebelled against the French in 1798, but were suppressed without much trouble. And so, Luxembourg remained an integral part of France throughout this period. They were administered by French officials, their children were educated in French schools, and their men served in the French army. Everyone paid French taxes. Skipping a bit ahead, after the Napoleonic Wars, the remaining great powers negotiated over the post-Napoleonic map of Europe. It was decided that to ensure the future peace of the continent, this strategic, highly defensible location should not belong to any one of the great powers. And so, the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg became an independent state, and has remained so ever since, with the exception of two periods of German occupation during the World Wars. Even today, French remains one of the administrative languages of the country. I would also add that I've visited Luxembourg, and people don't think of it as a tourist destination, but it is very beautiful, and I really had a good time there. So if you ever get a chance, go check out Luxembourg City. And imagine trying to face down the artillery on those cliffs. Next, Tom Dolan asked, which armies had the best firearms for accuracy and range? And did it matter much, considering that type of warfare, firing en masse? I can already hear the sharp fans in the audience clamoring to answer this question. the most accurate firearm for long-range fire that was in widespread use during the Napoleonic Wars was the British Baker rifle. The typical musket of this era was built for combat at distances under 100 yards, or 91 meters, often quite a bit under that distance. The Baker rifle was accurate up to 200 yards, so very roughly speaking, it was more than twice as accurate as the typical Napoleonic-era musket. There are even recorded cases of experienced marksmen making aimed shots at over 500 yards. Probably most famously, rifleman Thomas Plunkett of the 95th Rifles killed General Auguste Colbert with a shot from a Baker rifle at the Battle of Cacabelos in 1809, then followed it up with another perfect shot on one of Colbert's aides. Hobbyists and amateur historians sometimes talk about the Baker rifle like it was some kind of wonder weapon, probably at least in part due to its very memorable depiction in Bernard Cornwell's Sharp novels and the Sharp TV series. The Baker rifle was a remarkable weapon in many ways, but it had some real drawbacks as well. The rate of fire was significantly slower than that of a traditional musket, by somewhere between half and one-third. Baker rifles also required more maintenance. The barrels had to be cleaned roughly every 20 shots. Soot and gunpowder residue would build up in the rifling, and unless it was cleaned out relatively frequently, all that gunk would make it impossible to load a new round, effectively rendering the rifle useless. Their short barrels also made them a poor fit for bayonet combat. To equalize the length with a typical musket, the Baker rifle had to be equipped with an absolutely massive bayonet, which was heavy and cumbersome. So the Baker rifle had some unique capabilities, but some unique drawbacks as well. It had to be put in the hands of the right kind of soldier to take advantage of those capabilities and mitigate those drawbacks. Ideally, someone who was already a skilled marksman and already knew how to take care of a high-performance firearm. Only a tiny minority of men in the British Army fit the bill. But in the eyes of the British government, there was one drawback that loomed above all others. The Baker rifle was very expensive and difficult to produce. I have seen wildly different estimates of the costs of firearms in this era, and there would have been variation based on time, location, and circumstances, but it seems a Baker rifle cost somewhere around 50% more than a standard musket, and the production process was very inefficient. A gunsmith could produce several muskets in the time it took to create one Baker rifle. At a time when Britain was struggling to produce as many weapons as humanly possible, it made sense to focus most of the country's productive capacity on muskets, not rifles. As you alluded to in your question, range and accuracy were not primary concerns in Napoleonic combat. Battlefields of this era were dominated by volley fire at very close range. Accurate aimed shots from individual soldiers did play a role, but only situationally. This was a task for elite light infantry units, not for the average Napoleonic-era soldier. You actually see the same dynamic in modern militaries. The assault rifle is not the most accurate weapon for long-range fire. It, too, is designed for combat at limited distances. Tune in to the target shooting events at the Olympics, and you won't see anything that looks remotely like the weapons that the average modern soldier carries into battle. And so, despite their popularity with modern hobbyists and reenactors, less than 1% of the British soldiers of the Napoleonic Wars were equipped with Baker rifles. This was a specialty weapon, used by a small number of elite light infantry units. Next, Michael asked, how was Corsica treated under the Empire? Did Napoleon give them special status, or were they treated like any other province? Also, what did the Corsicans think of Napoleon's rise, especially influential people like Pauli? Corsica had no special status under the Empire. We've talked many times in past episodes about Napoleon's desire to centralize and standardize. Giving special status to a small, economically and politically unimportant island for purely personal, sentimental reasons was really not his style. Corsica did see some development under the empire, especially the capital, Napoleon's old hometown of Ajaccio. Some have pointed to this as evidence of favoritism, but Ajaccio had been a regional capital for a long time, and regional capitals all over the empire received similar investments. Perhaps, behind the scenes, Napoleon was placing a finger on the scale for his old hometown, but if he did, it was only very gently. Although he didn't show any official, detectable favoritism to Corsica as a region, he was very open to handing out patronage to members of his family. And if you'll think back to our early episodes, you might remember that family had a very expansive definition in Corsica, due to the island's clan system. Napoleon doled out a lot of patronage to his extended family, mostly in the form of government jobs. The Paris police was a favorite destination for distant cousins and members of the wider clan, to the point where, during the 19th century, the Paris police were often stereotypically depicted as Corsicans, much in the same way that American police forces of the same era are often stereotypically depicted as heavily Irish. So Corsica did benefit from having a son of the soil ruling in Paris, but only indirectly and not universally. As for what Corsicans thought of Napoleon's rise, this is a very complicated question, and I've seen a lot of different answers. As you might imagine, at least some people were proud that one of their own had risen to such commanding heights. This is still true today. Ajaccio's International Airport is named after Napoleon. There were many people who were benefiting directly or indirectly from Napoleon's largesse. And of course, Napoleon was popular all over France. Many people approved of his regime. However, there were also many in Corsica who felt differently. There was a sense among some that Bonaparte had turned his back on the island, and on his own Corsican identity. That was true to a certain extent. As we've discussed, he treated Corsica just like any other part of his empire. He generally spoke in French, wrote his correspondence in French, and even changed his name to sound more French. And of course, Napoleon was the figurehead of, and primary force in, the French government. Many on the island still harbored dreams of autonomy, or even independence. They saw Napoleon's government as an unwanted foreign presence. There had been a time when the young Napoleone di Buonaparte felt the same. His views had evolved as the revolution transformed France, but many Corsican patriots saw it differently. To them, he had turned his back on the cause as soon as it became convenient. As for Pasquale Paoli, we discussed his downfall and later life in Dispatch Number 6, so I won't go into too much detail here. But he was finally defeated by the Republicans in 1796 and went back into exile in Great Britain. His later years are a bit mysterious. He didn't write or socialize much, and was no longer a major celebrity and object of intellectual curiosity, as he had been during his first exile. He lived until 1807, long enough to watch Napoleon's rise to power from afar. As far as I know, he never recorded his thoughts on the subject, although given his history with the Bonapartes, I have to imagine they were quite negative. A more interesting case is someone you may remember from way back in our very earliest episodes, one of Napoleon's first political enemies, Carlo Andrea Pozzo di Borgo, a prominent member of a rival Ajaccio noble family who had been one of Napoleon's chief antagonists during his campaign to get elected lieutenant colonel of the Ajaccio National Guard. After his confrontation with the Bonapartes, Pozzo became one of Paoli's most trusted lieutenants. He was also a close collaborator with the British during their time on the island. After the Republicans retook Corsica, Pozzo went into exile, eventually finding his way to the Russian court. Emperor Alexander was well known for his eagerness to hire anyone who had ever crossed swords with Napoleon. Pozzo entered the Russian Foreign Service, and soon proved himself very valuable, and not only for his experience dealing with Napoleon, he had genuine skill as a diplomat. In this capacity, he was able to personally witness his old rival's final downfall at Waterloo. Pozzo had a very distinguished career that extended well beyond the end of the Napoleonic Wars. He served as Russia's ambassador to France for over 2 decades, and later as ambassador to Britain. He finally retired in 1839 and died in 1842. Next, Roman asked, did Morocco or other North African states try to take advantage of the war in Spain? What were their relationships with the European powers? In centuries past, the war in Spain probably would have been a golden opportunity for the North African states to strike back at a very old enemy. However, by 1808, this was not practical. In Napoleon's day, the period when the North African states were serious rivals to the European powers was long in the past. During the Renaissance and early modern periods, the governments and militaries of Europe had developed far faster. By the period we're talking about, they outclassed the North Africans by every conceivable metric. In fact, all through the early modern period, various European powers had conquered enclaves along the North African coast to use as commercial and military bases. These had all been eventually reconquered by the North Africans, but that should tell you something about the power imbalance here. There was no equivalent phenomenon of the North Africans seizing bases in southern Europe. It's also worth mentioning that by this point in history, most of the North African states were technically vassals of the Ottoman Empire. This is really not my area of expertise. I don't know if the Ottomans' North African vassals would have been technically allowed to declare war on their own, or if not, I don't know how much that would have mattered. But the bottom line is, most of the states in this region were not fully independent, and not completely free to pursue their own foreign policies. You may have heard of the famous Barbary Corsairs. These were privateers, or legal pirates from this part of the world, who preyed on shipping from Christian states, who refused to pay them protection money, much as the Knights of Malta had done to Muslim shipping. The heyday of the Corsairs was long past. They were at their height in the 16th and 17th centuries, but they were still present and active during this period. In fact, official support of the Corsairs brought several of these states into conflict with the young USA during this period. The Americans refused to pay protection money to the Corsairs. When American shipping was attacked, they responded with military force, leading to America's often forgotten first foreign conflict, the Barbary Wars. The Barbary Wars didn't overlap with the war in Spain. The first round ended in 1805, before Napoleon's intervention, and the second round didn't start until 1815, by which time the French had been ejected from the peninsula. The Barbary Wars were not complete victories for the Americans, but the treaties ending the conflicts were more favorable to the U.S. than to their North African opponents. And so the Americans were generally seen as the victors. Remember, at this point in history, the U.S. was still a new nation. The central government was very weak, and, strange as it may sound today, the U.S. military was very small, poorly funded, and poorly organized. Not many resources had been spent on the conflict in North Africa. In fact, a lot of the fighting had been done by locally hired mercenaries rather than American regulars. That should tell you something about the state of the militaries of North Africa. They had been bested by a minor secondary power from thousands of miles away, which hadn't even brought all its forces to bear. So launching some kind of play for power in Spain would have been far beyond the capabilities of any of the North African states of this period. Next, John asked, I'm curious about the activities of the royalist émigrés and the French court in exile. How were they faring, and what was their reaction to Napoleon's successes, especially after his coronation? I don't want to go into too much detail here, because these people will be re-entering our story at some point in the future, but I'll summarize briefly. By this point in our story, many of the émigrés had returned to France. Some remained, and they were joined by a small group of new émigrés, who had run afoul of Napoleon. But the high point of French immigration was in the 1790s, during the radical years of the Revolution. London remained the most important émigré center, but there were at least a few French exiles in almost every major city in Western countries not controlled by Napoleon, mostly in Europe, but you could also find them as far afield as the USA, Canada, and the Caribbean. I'll focus on the two most important émigrés, Louis-Stanislas Xavier, the Count of Provence, and Charles-Philippe, the Count of Artois, brothers of the executed Louis XVI and the future kings Louis XVIII and Charles X, respectively. When Louis first fled France, he went to Western Germany. This was the main destination for émigrés during the earliest phases of the Revolution. You may remember from our early episodes that émigré noblemen actually formed an army in the city of Koblenz, which fought alongside the Allies in the War of the First Coalition. Louis declared himself Regent of France, and demanded the complete rollback of all revolutionary reforms, and a return to the old regime. After the last king's only son died in 1795, a group of exiled noblemen declared Louis rightful King of France, although there was no coronation ceremony. That had to be done in France. Republican victories forced Louis out of Western Germany. Next, he went to Verona in Italy, but only about a year later, he was forced to flee again by advancing Republican forces, this time under General Napoleon Bonaparte. He finally found a more permanent sanctuary in the Russian Empire, specifically in modern-day Latvia. He lived there for over 10 years before the Treaty of Tilsit forced him to flee again, this time for England, where he remained until Napoleon's defeat. His brother Charles, the Count of Artois, had slightly better luck. He spent almost the entire period of the Revolution and the Empire in Edinburgh, Scotland. Some émigrés had very difficult lives in exile, leaving France with very little, having their property seized by the revolutionaries, and then trying to make a living in a foreign country, where they were not always welcome. On the other hand, the very upper crust of the nobility, like Charles and Louis, lived very well, generally on the charity of their hosts. During his time in the Russian Empire, Louis lived at the Jelgava Palace, a huge, opulent former residence of the Dukes of Courland. He did not pay rent and received a generous stipend from the Russian government, enabling him to maintain a lifestyle very similar to the one he had enjoyed before the Revolution. In England, Louis lived at Hartwell House, a country home near the city of Aylesbury, roughly between London and Oxford. If you know your English Civil War history, this was the former residence of John Hampden, cousin of Oliver Cromwell, and a major figure on the parliamentary side of the conflict. A bit ironic. The British government paid his rent, and the British royal family paid him a stipend, just as Emperor Alexander had done before. It was enough money that Louis was able to maintain something resembling a royal court in exile. As you may remember from past episodes, many royalist émigrés had initially greeted Napoleon's seizure of power with hope. They were thinking back on the history of the English Civil War. They believed Napoleon might play a similar role to a powerful general from that period, George Monk, who had facilitated the restoration of the monarchy. Louis wrote a letter to Napoleon, and sent agents to meet with him in person, but as you may remember, this had not gone the way the royalists had hoped. Napoleon did express some sympathy for the personal trials experienced by the Bourbon family, but made it clear that he had no intention of restoring the old regime. He even tried to convince Louis to renounce his claim to the throne. Early in their exile, the former royal family maintained an uncompromising, reactionary position. Everything the revolutionaries had done was illegal, immoral, and had to be rolled back. If the Bourbons ever returned to power, France would go back to the way things had been before the Estates General convened in 1789. We'll talk about this more in future episodes, but by this point in our story, they had retreated somewhat from that hard line. The course of political events in France, and the simple passage of time, had made a complete rollback to 1789 untenable, and the Bourbons recognized that. Although, as we'll see, publicly adopting a more liberal, conciliatory attitude and truly changing one's outlook are two very different propositions. Finally, I'd like to close out with a quotation from the memoirs of Captain Elzéar Blas. I read from Captain Blas's memoirs in the very first dispatch, so I think it's fitting to return to them for our 2-year anniversary. In this passage, Blas tells the story of his promotion from cadet to officer, and the experience of joining the Grande Armée on campaign in Poland. He was one of the young cadets called up to replace the losses of Eylau, so this would have been sometime in early to mid-1807. Anyway, from the memoirs of Captain Elzéar Blas. Quote, "One fine day, during a review, General Bellavaine announced the names of those who the next day were to depart for the army. Oh, what emotion while he was reading this list! Our hearts beat to bursting in our breasts. What joy among those chosen! What anxiety among those whose names had yet to be called! To put on an officer's coat, wear the epaulette, carry a sword. Oh, what fine things when one is 18 years old! We were privates. A moment after, we became officers. A single word had produced this happy metamorphosis. Man is always a child. At all ages, he needs a plaything. He often esteems himself according to the coat he wears. He is perhaps right, since the multitude judges according to the clothes. However that may be, with our second lieutenant's epaulettes, we thought we were something. A captain of the school was detailed to conduct us to the Emperor's general headquarters. We traveled post, so we said. The fact is that we were piled by the dozens in wagons, and that by going at a walking pace from morning until night, we made 2 stages a day. In all the towns, our greatest occupation was to have the sentinels present arms to us. Nothing was so funny as the serious air, and especially the indifference we affected when saluting them. All the old soldiers before whom we passed and repassed ceaselessly must have made great sport of our childishness. The ambition of each of us was to have a certain rakish air. We smoked and we drank liquor. We imagined that these good habits would give us a military appearance. Our clothes, our epaulettes, everything was new. Everything was fresh from the shop. We exposed them to the rain and sun, hoping to give them something of the look of the bivouac. In spite of this, the buttons of the school and our beardless faces betrayed us, and Captain Dornier, who marched at our head, showed sufficiently that with our weak old epaulettes, we were still but schoolboys. We traveled merrily, for we were young, without cares, and full of hope. While going through Prussia, then through Poland, then again through Prussia, now well, now badly, we always laughed. It was at the birthplace of Copernicus, at Thorn, that we noticed that we were in the neighborhood of Napoleon's army. That city, encumbered with men from almost all the regiments, had half its houses transformed into hospitals. We were obliged to take lodgings in granaries or stables. We were beginning to think that war might possibly not be the most beautiful thing in the world. The army at that time occupied the encampments which it had taken after the Battle of Eylau, won by the French, and by the Russians, as they said. Napoleon was at Finkenstein, reviewing, repairing the losses of February, imparting to all his extraordinary activity. It is there that for the first time I saw that astonishing man, of whom some have attempted to make a god, and whom certain imbeciles have called a fool. He has proved that he was neither one nor the other. The judgments passed on him to this day have been too close to the events to be free from partiality. For a long time to come, it will be impossible to write a good history of Napoleon. For such a thing to be, his contemporaries and their sons will have to be dead, enthusiasm cooled, hatred dead. Then, and not until then, a man free from prejudice, consulting the thousands of volumes already written, and those to be, will be able to find the truth in the well. Out of these materials, a monument shall rise, superb and imperishable. To assist in this grand construction, I bring a grain of sand." End quote. Now, I hope it goes without saying that I don't consider this show to be that superb, imperishable monument. I think Blas was speaking more generally about the body of history that would someday emerge to describe these events. I do think it's fascinating that even in his own time, immediately after the Napoleonic Wars, the captain already had a sense of what a polarizing figure Napoleon would be to historians. Even today, long after the children of the people who experienced the Napoleonic Wars have died, there are still people who try to make Napoleon into a god, and there are still certain imbeciles who call him a fool. Anyway, that's all for now. I'll be back to you soon with more from the main narrative. Until then, thank you again for your support, and here's to 2 more years.